Welcome to the third season of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, November 24th, the last Sunday in the month, beginning the week that includes Thanksgiving. We begin with Bookshelf from the combined July 13th, July 27th, 2024 issue of Science News. The world has water problems. This book has solutions. The book reviewed is The Last Drop by Tim Smedley, published by Picador. A journalist and a farmer visit three fields with different styles of cultivation, conventional, organic, and no-till, to bury cotton underwear in each. Though this sounds like the beginning of a bad joke, it's actually a test of soil health. Healthy soil that produces robust crops holds plenty of water and teems with life that will feast on the undies. This scene is just one of many in UK-based journalists Tim Smedley's book, The Last Drop. The book provides an exhaustively reported primer on the world's water problems and dives into potential fixes, including agricultural remedies, policy changes, tech innovations, and at-home solutions like rainwater harvesting. The world isn't running out of water. People are, Smedley writes. He travels to the Hoover Dam in the American Southwest to see the low water levels at Lake Mead. He visits the Middle East, stopping by Jordan's Karema Dam, where the impounded water has become too saline for irrigation. Closer to home, he tours Europe's largest artificial lake, Northern England's Kielder Water, which was constructed during the late 1970s in anticipation of a water demand that petered out within about a decade of completion. It's the southern half of the country that has become water-stressed. Such megaprojects highlight how water crises are usually caused by all-too-human mismanagement, not climate, Smedley writes. But climate change is certainly making things worse, he adds. As climate change bites, precipitation patterns change. For instance, the warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor, a greenhouse gas that exacerbates warming and fuels massive storms that unleash devastating floods. Flooding can make water pollution worse. Runoff from storms carries extra nitrogen and phosphorus from farms, a punami of livestock-sourced manure, which contains those elements, contaminates freshwater supplies, as do fertilizers. Some agrochemicals, Smedley writes, have been tied to increases in pediatric cancer cases. Changes to farming practices, just some of the solutions that Smedley explores, could mitigate pollution, water scarcity, and potentially flooding all at once. No-till agriculture results in root systems, webs of fungi, and burrowing bugs that maintain a spongy soil that sucks up water. Because they hold more water, these fields can better weather dry spells. Their soil structure helps them resist erosion, minimizing runoff. They also need far less fertilizer because fungi and other microbes, in conjunction with cover crops planted between growing seasons, maintain and return nutrients to the soil. England's water woes, shortages are an issue despite the reputation for heavy rainfall, could be solved through no-till farming alone, Smedley's reporting reveals. As for the interred underwear, after a couple of months, Smedley and the farmer unearth dusty, holy pants from the organic field, whereas the conventional farm produced dirty yet wearable ones. The no-till field, unplowed for decades, turned up a bedraggled mess of soil, fungal residue, and purple patches, along with a millipede that leaped from the scraps and scurried away. Smedley packs his book with sometimes funny, often serious insights that people can apply to their lives. Most of the water footprint of people in the Western world, for example, comes not from tap water used for bathing, cooking, and cleaning, but from the water that goes into making the products we consume. Depending on where and how it's grown, and the specifics of the calculations, tossing a browned avocado can waste 273 liters of water. A single steak can cost 2,000 liters. If you're wearing a t-shirt made from cotton grown in Egypt, Smedley writes, You are, in a sense, wearing water from Egypt. Given all the water we waste, Smedley notes, small changes can make a big difference. The last drop doesn't mean waiting for the water to run out, he explains. It means valuing every last drop as precious. This review of The Last Drop, Solving the World's Water Crisis, written by Tim Smedley, was reviewed by Alka Tripathi Lang. 3 weeks ago, I read an article from the New York Times. The world's doomsday plant vault gets thousands of new seeds. A storage facility in Norway built to safeguard crop diversity recently received more than 30,000 samples as concerns grow about climate change and food insecurity. The article was posted on October 29, 2024. In the October 2024 issue of Scientific American, the column Observatory Keeping an Eye on Science explores the seed vault as well. Written by Naomi Oreskes, Parable of the Svalbard Seed Vault, an Arctic repository for agricultural plant diversity, embodies the flawed logic of climate adaptation. At a latitude of 78 degrees north lies the northernmost city in the world. It is an odd place. Way above the Arctic Circle, a mere 814 miles from the North Pole, Longyearbyen in Norway's Svalbard archipelago is home to only 2,400 people, but more than 1.3 million seeds. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault is an underground storage facility designed to secure seeds to ensure that food crop varieties are not lost in the event of a global crisis, such as war, terrorism, or climate change. Touted as our insurance policy that we're going to be able to feed the world in 50 years, the vault has been situated at a location and depth in the Arctic, intended to ensure that the seeds will not rot or sprout and will be available for use when needed. For further safety, the vault is refrigerated to 0 degrees Fahrenheit and designed to withstand a magnitude 10 earthquake. For comparison, the quake that produced the tsunami that devastated Fukushima, Japan, was magnitude 9. On the surface, the seed repository sounds like a very solid idea, but it rests on shaky foundations. The vault opened in 2008, following an earlier iteration in which seeds were stored in a nearby coal mine. It is not specifically a response to the threat of climate change, but it is an epitome of climate adaptation thinking. The logic behind it goes like this. Climate change is underway, and our political systems seem to be incapable of meaningful action to stop it. So we have little choice but to plan for a future when we will face serious climate disruption. Chief among the disturbances will be disruptions to the food supply, as punishing droughts and heat waves lead to widespread seasonal crop failures, and important individual food species become impossible to grow in the places where people are used to growing them. When that happens, a supply of diverse seeds, including some adapted to hotter, harsher climates, may be just the thing we need to protect our food systems and stave off disaster. It's good to be realistic about the climate future we are facing, but the seed vault embeds a conceit common to many adaptation plans. We know what we are facing, so if we plan well, things will go well. But already chinks in the vault's armor have appeared. In 2017, the vault suffered a flood caused, ironically, by climate change. A very warm but increasingly not exceptional winter, combined with heavy spring rain, to thaw part of the surrounding permafrost, flooding the entrance and threatening the safety of the seeds. Changes have been made to the vault's entrance to lessen this particular risk, but the breach, less than a decade after the vault opened, shows that we humans are not very good at anticipating change, even in the short run. Boosters of the seed vault sustain the logic of their effort in part by effacing the embarrassment of the flood. The timeline of the vault on the website of the vault's partner, Crop Trust, does not mention it. When asked about the flood by a reporter for The Guardian, a representative of the Norwegian government, which owns and operates the vault, said, It was not in our plans to think that the permafrost would not be there and that it would experience extreme weather like that. The question is whether this is just happening now or will it escalate? You don't have to be a climate scientist to know the Arctic is losing permafrost. In Svalbard, the dislocation is obvious even to an untrained eye. And it's long been known that the Arctic would warm more rapidly than the rest of the globe. Princeton University geophysicist Sayukuro Manabe predicted this effect, known as polar amplification, in the 1970s. He belatedly won a Nobel Prize in 2021 for this work. Today, the Arctic is warming four times faster than the rest of the planet. Even if the entire world were to stop burning fossil fuels now, global temperatures would not return to normal for decades or centuries to come. Given the state of action or inaction on climate, we don't have to ask whether Arctic warming and permafrost loss will escalate. It is a near certainty. That is not the only problem with the thinking behind the sea vault. Proponents describe it as a safeguard against catastrophic starvation. But there are reasons to doubt it would function that way. Scholars at the University of British Columbia noted that seeds isolated from the environment do not evolve, so if they are reintroduced decades from now, they may face a natural world to which they are no longer adapted. Because of this biological lag, Svalbard's diligently protected seeds might turn out to be useless, unable to grow or survive. The vault's focus on seeds also neglects crucially important food crops, such as cassava, that are not typically propagated through seeds. And if we truly were threatened by global starvation, how likely is it that the seeds could be retrieved, distributed, and sown, and the crops reaped in time to feed the world? The problem of biological lag could be addressed by regular updating of the stored seeds with new samples taken from nature, but that is expensive. Even without such updating, the expense of the vault, it cost 8.3 million euros to build, 20 million to upgrade, and 1 million a year to maintain, makes one wonder if it is really a good use of conservation resources and scientific effort. And then there is its carbon footprint. Maintaining the vault at its chilly minus 0.4 degree Fahrenheit requires electricity from the public power plant in Longyearbyen, which runs on fossil fuel. It's smart to plan for the future, but the seed vault assumes that we know enough to plan effectively and that people will pay attention to what we know. History shows that this is often not the case. The difficulties of the seed vault remind us that the most important thing we can do right now is not to plan to respond to climate change after it happens, but to do everything in our power to prevent it while we still have that chance. This opinion piece in Observatory Keeping an Eye on Science is written by Naomi Oreskes, a professor of the history of science at Harvard University. She is author of Why Trust Science, which was published in 2019 by Princeton University Press, and co-author of The Big Myth, published by Bloomsbury in 2023. This column appears in the October 2024 issue of Scientific American. Parable of the Svalbard Seed Vault, an Arctic repository for agricultural plant diversity, embodies the flawed logic of climate adaptation. A second column from this October 2024 issue of Scientific American reflects on Nobel Prizes. From the Department of Graphic Science, Nobel Connections, a deep dive into science's greatest prize, written by Sarah Lewin Fraser. The graphic by Jen Christensen. Meteorologist Sayukuro Manabe shared the 2021 Nobel Prize in Physics for his work modeling gases' movement through a column of atmospheric air in the 1960s. His 60-year-old research had proved foundational for the computer models that scientists use today to interpret and predict our changing climate. Manabe's wait was particularly long, but there is often a substantial gap between the awarding of a Nobel Prize and the earliest work it honors, an average of 20 years across categories, Scientific American found. It takes time to prove that something has impact beyond just curiosity, says John Ioannidis, a Stanford University professor who has examined the Nobel's distribution and influence. Although the awards are not a representative look at all of science, they reveal the trends and incentives shaping key scientific fields. We at the magazine wondered what subfields of science have been most celebrated, and whether there are visible patterns related to the amount of time between the research and the recognition. We used the official Nobel synopses and statements to sort the awards into our own subdiscipline categories and to inform research dates on a timeline that shows the trends. One clear pattern is the increase in multiple laureates per prize. Each award can be split among a maximum of three living researchers, but that rule is increasingly constraining as science becomes more collaborative. This stipulation may even skew what gets highlighted as the most significant research going forward, Ioannidis suggests. If a Nobel committee cannot pick only three individuals responsible for a result, it's not easy to have someone who really stands out so separately from the rest of the world. Orange-fleshed sweet potato, truly an emerging superfood in Ethiopia. Substituting this colorful root vegetable for flour in bread or white-fleshed sweet potatoes in daily cooking can tackle the prevalent vitamin A deficiency in the African country and throughout sub-Saharan Africa. The cover feature of CSA News, the July 2024 issue. Nearly half of preschool-aged children in Ethiopia are deficient in vitamin A, a deficiency that leads to blindness, stunted growth, and even death. As of 2019, some 30 to 49% of children under age 5 were considered stunted. Vitamin A deficiency kills 80,000 people annually in Ethiopia and 600,000 or more annually around the world, predominantly young children or expectant mothers. Yet the problem could be solved, scientists say. One baseball-sized amount of orange-fleshed sweet potato a day meets the daily vitamin A requirements for a small child, offering a simple yet effective remedy. While addressing vitamin A deficiency seems straightforward, and it is in a lot of ways, distributing orange-fleshed sweet potato, OFSP, presents its own set of challenges. Scientists aren't giving up, though. They've figured out and cultivated different varieties of sweet potatoes appealing to both adults and children. Puree made from OFSP can cost-effectively replace 30 to 60% of wheat flour in baked goods. They've created toolkits to help mothers know how much and how frequently to feed their kids. They've gotten the OFSPs into the hands of farmers, rural households, and sellers. And they created a massive marketing campaign emphasizing the health benefits of orange foods. Orange-fleshed sweet potato, pumpkin, mango, papaya, carrots, all contain beta-carotene, the dietary precursor to vitamin A. The results of the interventions so far are promising. Crop Science has published a special section stemming from research presented at the 12th Triennial African Potato Association Conference. Two of the papers in the section suggest a decline in vitamin A deficiency as OFSP is becoming more common across Ethiopia and sub-Saharan Africa thanks to these interventions. Solving the vitamin A issue and other forms of malnutrition in sub-Saharan Africa isn't going to take just one type of intervention, says Jan Lowe, an emeritus scientist with the International Potato Center, CIP, in Nairobi, and a 2016 World Food Prize co-laureate. It's not an either-or situation, she says. It's going to take behavior change interventions at the household level to have more diverse diets, an improved vine multiplication and distribution system, marketing and education campaigns, policy reform, more biofortification and healthy soils research, and more. Why focus on orange-fleshed sweet potatoes? Sub-Saharan Africa grapples with malnutrition for two primary reasons. Either lack of sufficient calories, undernourished, or lack of a quality diet full of vitamins and minerals, micronutrient malnourished. Sub-Saharan Africa has the highest incidence of chronic hunger in the world. It also has the highest rates of hidden hunger, micronutrient malnutrition. Diets across the region rely on staple foods like maize, rice, and wheat for half to three-quarters of daily calories, and fruits, vegetables, and animal products are inadequately consumed as they are too expensive for most people. The wheat and maize people rely on are usually stripped of their bran to make white flour, so they don't even have fiber or micronutrients left. When a micronutrient-poor food accounts for 50 to 75% or more of a person's diet, micronutrient deficiencies abound. This is especially the case for young children in Ethiopia, who are primarily fed a thin porridge from wheat or maize. If households enhanced porridges with diverse ingredients of the appropriate thickness, including OFSP, they could significantly better the young child diet, Lowe says. Orange-fleshed sweet potato provides an excellent source of vitamin A and is a good source of vitamins C, E, K, several B vitamins, and minerals like potassium and manganese. Lowe says OFSP also provides fiber and natural sugars, making it a great energy source. In the West, OFSP has been named a superfood for its nutritional content. The roots have been found to increase blood levels of vitamin A, especially when eaten with a fat source. But it's not just the roots that can be eaten. The leaves also provide an excellent source of micronutrients like lutein, which prevents eye degeneration, Lowe says. You can cook them like collard or turnip greens, and they have even more protein than many leafy vegetables. Vines and leaves can also be fed to livestock, which increases milk output in dairy cows by 20% or more. Furthermore, growers use the vines or the sweet potatoes themselves to propagate the crop from year to year. No part of the plant goes to waste, Lowe says. How easily and where the plant grows also makes OFSP a popular choice for nutritionists trying to solve the vitamin A crisis in Africa. It grows across the tropics, from sea level to 2,400 meter elevation, Lowe says. Hardy and versatile, OFSP can produce two to three crops per year for harvest, and once established, it can withstand droughts. So it really fits into a system under stress due to the changing climate, Lowe says. Furthermore, it has a lot of genetic diversity that allows breeders to select varieties adapted to many different microclimates and soils, from hot, sandy soils at the coast to cooler, volcanic soils on high plateaus. There are more than 3,000 different varieties of sweet potato maintained in the Global Gene Bank at the CIP headquarters in Peru. Agronomic interventions. Since they started working on introducing OFSP to sub-Saharan Africa in 1985, CIP and researchers have bred more than 100 different biofortified varieties of OFSP in the region, says Joel Rank, head of communications at CIP. Scientists develop new biofortified varieties of OFSP through conventional yet accelerated breeding techniques, which are also described in the special section of crop science. Biofortification means having a very high content of at least one key micronutrient bred into a staple food, so it is a source of energy and a micronutrient essential for good health, Lowe says. Developing a new variety of OFSP takes about 4 years of field trials under diverse agroecological pressures. First, researchers determine what benefit a particular OFSP has that they want to marry with another. For example, one variety is resistant to a particular pest that's prevalent in an area, and another has the right texture that consumers in that area want for eating. Then they make crosses of these varieties and test under different soil and climatic conditions, see what works. Once they develop a new variety, they test it on farms and with traders and consumers. Then they keep the best crop, parents, and start the process anew until they get exactly the OFSP traits they want. Over nearly 40 years of research, scientists at CIP and elsewhere have tested a lot of sweet potatoes, Rank says. Some of the varieties they have developed are to address taste preferences. In the United States, consumers tend to like moister OFSPs, the type we'd make into a sweet potato pie or a sweet potato casserole at Thanksgiving. Those have about 18 to 22% dry matter, Lowe says. Kids in Africa also tend to like that texture, but adults largely don't, considering it watery. Most African adults tend to prefer drier, mealier OFSPs with about 28 to 35% dry matter. So providing different varieties to meet varying preferences and uses, boiled, roasted, baked, and fried, helps get the sweet potato into wider use, Rank says. Other varieties developed by CIP and other researchers are more drought-tolerant, more pest or disease-resistant, or higher-yielding, says Temezigan Fitamo-Boucher, a former agricultural economist with CIP and Save the Children, who is now at World Vision Canada. The crop already produces high yields from small plots, he says, which makes it ideal for a backyard garden or a small farm. But it can also scale up easily for bigger farms to sell into marketplaces in urban areas. However, he says, there has to be a market, people willing to buy the product, before farmers will start growing large amounts of sweet potatoes. Social and household interventions. Creating a market is indeed one of the biggest challenges to even wider spread adoption of OFSP throughout Ethiopia and sub-Saharan Africa, Lowe says. That starts by reaching consumers, largely women. Where there's been success so far, Kenya, Uganda, and Ghana, for example, it's been because outreach has focused on community-based nutrition programs to reach rural women and men with young children and school feeding programs for older children, Rank says. In school feeding programs, he adds, OFSP has been offered for lunch, getting kids to try it and like it, and then the school hands out vouchers for kids to take home to their parents to get OFSP vines from growers. Then they grow it at home in their kitchen garden, which provides a significant source of food security in rural areas. Reaching women can also start at prenatal clinics for pregnant women, Boucher says. Many pregnant women in sub-Saharan Africa are vitamin A deficient, as are many lactating women with newborns. They need the vitamin themselves, but they also need to pass it along to their babies. One such intervention is through provision of the Healthy Baby Toolkit to mothers with children under age 2. It's a bowl with lines and symbols that show the appropriate volume of food and frequency of feedings for children of varying ages, from 6 months through 2 years, and it comes with a slotted spoon to help parents judge the optimal thickness of the ubiquitous porridge. The idea is that the optimal porridge has a consistency that can't drip through the spoon. The bowl also has a line that indicates the amount of additional food a pregnant or lactating mother should eat daily. Many parents don't know how much to feed their infants or toddlers, Boucher says, nor do they know how often to feed them or what consistency their food should be. They often underfeed their kids by accident, feeding too little, not often enough, or with porridge that's too thin. The bowl and slotted spoon take the guesswork out of it. Boucher, Lowe, and Roland Brouwer of Zangela in Mozambique studied how the Healthy Baby Toolkit, developed by Emory University, worked in concert with other OFSP interventions in southern Ethiopia. Participants, 15,000 rural households with pregnant and lactating women, infants, and young children, were given the toolkit, nutrition education, 600 OFSP vine cuttings to plant on their land, and training in improved farming practices. We saw a statistically significant impact, Boucher says, that encouraged us to continue intervening. they not only saw increases in intakes of vitamin A, estimated based on food intake surveys, but also observed increases in food security and dietary diversity, he says, even though the area was impacted by drought during the study. Participants reported having more to eat and more variety in their diet during this study. The Healthy Baby Toolkit has proven so effective, in fact, that UNICEF, the World Food Program, and other organizations that intervene during food crises have started handing it out, Lowe says. It's really a breakthrough innovation, but that intervention alone doesn't make as much of a difference in the diets of young families as using the Healthy Baby Toolkit in concert with the providing access to quality seed of nutritious crops like OFSP and enhanced nutrition education, Boucher says. Another intervention that's proven effective in providing a nutritional boost involves replacing some of the wheat flour and teff flour in bread and injera, a fermented flatbread widely consumed in Ethiopia, with OFSP puree. Asheber Mengesha, a nutritionist at CIP in Ethiopia, and colleagues studied the nutritional content of bread and injera that had varying amounts of OFSP puree, replacing flour in the two grain products. They tested the textures and flavors to determine the most popular ratios, ranging from 15% OFSP puree with 85% wheat or teff flour to 45-55 OFSP puree to wheat teff, and then tested the beta-carotene levels in the bread and injera. In both grain products, beta-carotene contents exhibited an increasing trend as the proportion of OFSP puree blended with wheat and teff flours increased from 15 to 45%, Mengesha says. Consumers generally found all of the products acceptable to eat, Mengesha and his team reported, but best sensory qualities combined with high beta-carotene levels were bread and injera, made from 30% OFSP puree and 70% wheat or teff flour. Therefore, grain products made from the 30-70 blend is recommended for commercial production and consumption among urban and rural consumers, including the most vulnerable groups to vitamin A deficiency, he says. Replacing 30% of wheat flour with OFSP in 100 grams of bread can contribute to 52% and 47.2% of vitamin A to 2 to 3 and 4 to 5 year old children's recommended daily allowance, respectively, Mengesha and his team wrote. Likewise, replacing 30% of teff flour with OFSP puree in 100 grams of injera can contribute to 54% and 48% of vitamin A to 2 to 3 and 4 to 5-year-old children's recommended daily allowance, respectively. The golden-hued bread produced with OFSP also has other benefits, the team reported, such as better shelf stability, softer texture, and less microbial growth than standard bread. Additionally, OFSP offers economic advantages. OFSP is cheaper than wheat flour and can be grown locally, and the price and demand for wheat and teff grains have been increasing, making them unaffordable to low-income consumers. Injera is usually made in the home, while bread is usually bought at a market, especially in urban areas, Mengesha notes. Thus, to get this intervention widely accepted, we'll take a strong value chain. Farmers are needed to grow the roots. The bakery industry is needed to process the OFSP and make the breads. Traders or markets are needed to sell the baked goods, and consumers need to purchase the products. All of these different actors play a valuable role, Mengesha says. Even the government needs to get involved to start incentivizing and promoting OFSP to partially substitute for maize or wheat flour, he adds. Fortunately, CIP is working with the government of Ethiopia on a strategy to increase OFSP uptake throughout the country, Mengesha says. The International Potato Center is also promoting OFSP through social and traditional media campaigns, such as using influencers and radio ads. Other governments in sub-Saharan Africa are also working with CIP to increase adoption of OFSP. The International Potato Center, the IPC, has already gotten OFSP into more than 7 million households across Africa, Rank says, which is a good start. Future work. Despite progress, challenges remain, particularly regarding seed distribution and soil degradation. Probably the single biggest challenge facing OFSP adoption is the seed business, Lowe says. Because OFSP grows from vines, growers can store vines cut from last season and plant them again. There's little money to be made in seeds, so commercial operators aren't interested. Thus, as of now, there just aren't enough vines to go around, unless there is strong government or non-governmental organizational support. Another problem with this system, though, is that over time, vines recycled year after year can become affected by viruses, which can lead to lower yields or other problems. Growers need periodic access to disease-free, clean seeds, Lowe says. Hence, we have been promoting combined vine root enterprises, where trained quality vine multipliers also engage in commercial root production. When demand for vines for planting is low, when farmers retain and replant their own vines, multipliers can convert their vines into root production for sale. This will be key to the value chain working, she says. Typically, it takes grant organizations or government support to get the vine enterprise system set up, and then CIP and others need to work with local farmers to help them realize the value of clean seed. Soil degradation is an even harder challenge to solve, as it varies significantly, Lowe says. But breeding OFSP to be able to tolerate poor soils and harsh conditions is possible, so that's another line of research. Overall, Lowe says, though there's more work to be done, sweet potato has proven itself to be a climate-smart intervention that contributes toward building the healthier food system the world needs. These interventions make a difference. And this article, Orange-Fleshed Sweet Potato, Truly an Emerging Superfood in Ethiopia, appears in the latest issue of CSA News, July 2024. CSA News, Crop Science, Soil Science, Agronomy, is the official monthly magazine for members of the American Society of Agronomy, ASA, Crop Science Society of America, CSSA, and Soil Science Society of America, SSSA. Now we turn to New York Times Trilobite to understand the insights that cheese can provide. This cheese stood alone for 3,600 years. The cheese was dug up with mummified human remains in the Xinjiang region of China, and offers insights into the origins of the dairy product known as kefir. Posted on September 25, 2024, this New York Times Trilobite was written by Kate Golembievsky. Around 3,600 years ago, a young woman died and was buried in the Tarim Basin, a desert in what's now the Xinjiang region of northwestern China. The dry conditions and her sealed coffin preserved her body, so when archaeologists uncovered her grave in 2003, they found her naturally mummified remains, still dressed in a felt hat, tasseled wool coat, and fur-lined leather boots. They also found chunks of cheese, laid out like a necklace. This dairy decoration is the oldest cheese in the world, said Dr. Fu, a paleogeneticist at the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology, Chinese Academy of Sciences. In a study published a few months ago in the journal Cell, Dr. Fu led a genetic analysis of the dairy products and microbes present in cheese from the Tarim Basin, shedding light on how it was made. Humanity's love affair with cheese goes back millenniums. Scientists have found fatty residues on 7,000-year-old pottery that were most likely from cheese, and 4,000-year-old Sumerian texts mention the dairy product. But the Tarim Basin samples are the oldest substances in the world that scientists can confidently call cheese. Dr. Fu and her team took samples of cheese scattered about the necks of three mummies from the basin. They chemically isolated the fragments of DNA that remained and compared them with the genomes of modern species involved in the cheese-making process. They found traces of cow and goat DNA, indicating that the milk of both animals were used in the ancient cheese. They were also able to track down the DNA of microbes responsible for fermenting the milk into cheese. The researchers found species of bacteria and yeast that, together with milk, coagulate into clumps called kefir grains, which are used to produce fermented, yogurt-like kefir milk and soft, sour kefir cheese. For Dr. Fu, identifying the microbe species that produced the ancient cheese was really, really exciting, because cheese-making practices can hint at how people lived and whom they interacted with. The inclusion of the cheese in burials indicates that it was valued, and the multiple milk sources and the kind of bacteria used suggests potential interactions between people in the Tarim Basin, the Chaohoshe, and peoples from the Eurasian steppe. It's a new way of tracking what human cultures were doing long before or in the absence of language or written accounts, said Paul Kinstedt, a cheese historian and professor emeritus of food science at the University of Vermont, who was not involved with the new study. At the time the cheese was buried, it was most likely soft and tangy, not unlike modern kefir. To Dr. Fu's knowledge, no one has tasted the crumbly bits that were pulled out of the tomb. I think people don't want to try it because we see that it's not that attractive, she said. But if they did taste it, they might have been disappointed. Some archaeologists sampled cheese they found in an Egyptian tomb in the 1930s, and their paper from 1942 noted that it had no smell and only a dusty taste. However, Dr. Fu and her colleagues are keen to try to recreate the cheese based upon the information they've gleaned about its production. I think next step, we should make it, she said. And what about that cheese found in Egypt? To learn more, we turn to a BBC report from August 18, 2018. Ancient Egypt, cheese discovered in a 3,200-year-old tomb. A substance found by archaeologists working in an ancient Egyptian tomb has proved to be one of the oldest cheeses ever discovered. Several years ago, the team discovered broken jars in the tomb of Ptahmes, a high-ranking Egyptian official. The archaeologists found a solidified whitish mass in one of the jars, which they suspected was food, but were unsure which kind. Now a study has identified it as cheese, dating from 3,200 years ago. The discovery is significant as there has been no previous evidence of ancient Egyptian cheese production. Authors of the report, which was published in the journal Analytical Chemistry, said, "The material analyzed is probably the most ancient archaeological solid residue of cheese ever found to date. And at that time it was," said Dr. Enrico Greco from the University of Catania, who worked with colleagues at the Cairo University in Egypt to determine its identity. "We know it was made mostly from sheep's and goat's milk, but for me it's really hard to imagine a specific flavor." The ancient cheese would have had a really, really acidy bite, cheese historian and chemistry professor Paul Kinstedt told the New York Times. The researchers said they also found traces of a bacterium that can cause an infectious disease known as brucellosis, which comes from consuming unpasteurized dairy products. Symptoms include fever, sweating, and muscle aches, and the disease still exists today. If confirmed, it would be the oldest evidence of such a case. The tomb where the cheese was found belonged to Ptahmes, an Egyptian official who was mayor of the ancient city of Memphis. The burial site at the necropolis near Cairo was first unearthed in 1885, but after being lost to shifting sands, it was rediscovered in 2010. Ancient Egypt, cheese discovered in a 3,200-year-old tomb. BBC report from August 18, 2018. And now we turn to the February 2024 issue of Scientific American. Under question and answer with Ed Curry. How hot is Pepper X? The creator reveals his experience tasting the hottest pepper in the world. By Stephanie Pappas. A new world record holder has entered the field of hot peppers, Pepper X. This proprietary pepper, bred by Ed Curry, was recognized in October 2023 by Guinness World Records as the hottest pepper ever independently tested. Curry is one of the few people to have tried Pepper X raw. By all reports, the taste test involves a burning sensation followed by several hours of intestinal cramping. With a spiciness level of 2.693 million Scoville heat units, or SHU, on average, Pepper X handily unseated the previous hottest pepper on Earth, the Carolina Reaper, also bred by Curry, who founded the Puckerbutt Pepper Company, a hot pepper farm and pepper product supplier in Fort Mill, South Carolina. For comparison, jalapenos reach 2,000 to 8,000 SHU. Scientific American caught up with Curry to talk about his heat-seeking trajectory and whether hot peppers can get even spicier. An edited transcript of the interview follows. Question: what is it like in the world of hot pepper breeding? Is it a competitive field? In the pepper breeding world, there are really only a few of us who intentionally breed peppers, and they get what's called an odd phenotype and think they've got a new pepper. It's not that competitive. If it were, the Carolina Reaper wouldn't have held a record for 10 years. That's more just stuff on the internet. Most of the people who actually breed peppers aren't on social media. We talk via the phone. Question: what does the day-to-day life of a pepper breeder look like? Half the year, we're processing peppers by drying them or turning them into pepper paste. The other half of the year, we're breeding peppers. We cross-pollinate plants that have the attributes we want. If the resulting fruit has what we're looking for, we take the seeds out and plant them. If that comes out the same, that's the first generation. It takes anywhere between 8 and 12 generations to stabilize a plant, so you can start doing the testing. At Puckerbutt, we don't just breed peppers. We're one of the largest hot pepper farms in the U.S. We make hot sauce and pepper mash and dried pepper and pepper powder for all sorts of different manufacturers. Right now, I'm making test batches of hot sauce, doing interviews, and drying peppers at the same time. Question: when you're breeding peppers, what other attributes might you look for besides heat? 99% of what we do is for flavor and looks. I like getting peppers to look really weird or breeding out different colors. Question: what's your favorite weird pepper that you've bred? We have a particular variety of chocolate scotch bonnet that we call a UFO bonnet because it kind of looks like UFOs in pictures. It is a delicious pepper. It's not very high on the Scoville scale, but it is my absolute favorite pepper to eat. Don't get me wrong, I eat the super hot ones on a daily basis, but my favorites aren't super hot. They're in the mid-range of the pepper world. Editor's note: the Scoville scale measures the number of times an extraction of a pepper's capsaicinoids needs to be diluted with a mix of sugar and water before a professional panel of tasters can no longer detect those hot compounds. In laboratory tests, a machine called a high-performance liquid chromatograph can quantify capsaicinoids and other compounds in dried samples of peppers. Question: what makes Pepper X so hot? The compound that makes peppers hot is called capsaicin. There are many different capsaicinoids, and these compounds react with a nerve receptor that only mammals have that sends a signal to our brain saying, "This is hot." There are a lot of other compounds that can enhance the heat or tame the heat. You can increase the tannin levels in a pepper that is not so hot, such as a Scotch bonnet, and it gives you the perception of more heat. For Pepper X, I took a pepper that had a different set of capsaicinoids and bred it with the Reaper, and it turned out really hot. 9 out of 10 crossbreeds that we do go nowhere, and we have no expectation when we start. It's just playing around and having fun with science. Question: what is eating Pepper X like? In hot sauce and in salsa and candy and things, it tastes delicious. But when it is eaten raw, the flavor lasts only for a millisecond, and then the heat is just taking off. And it's not a very pleasant experience. I wouldn't recommend eating it raw to anybody, and if somebody wants me to do it again, they're going to have to pay me a lot of money. A reaper usually takes me about half an hour to recover from, including the cramps. Pepper X took me 5 to 6 hours. But I ate more peppers for dinner that night. Question: what's the advantage of having a super hot pepper? The advantage of the super hot peppers is economy of scale. Say you're using cayenne to get a pepper sauce as hot as you want it. You might use 2 to 3 pounds of cayenne, whereas with Pepper X, to get the same heat, you would need maybe just 1/8 of a gram of dried pepper. I'll give you an example. There was a manufacturer who was using 11.55 gallon drums of a pepper in a recipe. I knew one of the executives there, and I said, just try it with 1 15-gallon drum of Reaper. They got the same heat and saved 80% of the money they were spending. Final question: do you think you can go hotter? Oh yeah, I know we can. We've tested a lot of peppers at a higher level, but we don't yet have a lot of years of averages. You show the average of the tests when you're reporting the Scoville rating. You don't show your single highest test. I think we can achieve a lot more, but there's really not much use for it, unless it tastes good. And this Q&A with Ed Curry: how hot is Pepper X? It appears in the Scientific American February 2024 issue. And speaking of birds, this book review from the April 2024 issue of Scientific American, Brooding and Cocky: How the Strange Relationship Between Chickens and Humans Shaped Our World. It's a nonfiction book entitled Foul Play: A History of the Chicken from Dinosaur to Dinner Plate by Sally Coulthard, published by Apollo in 2024. As you're reading this or listening to it, there are more than 20 billion chickens alive on the planet. They live absolutely everywhere, except for Antarctica, playing important roles not just in our kitchens, but in our cultures. In this extremely well-researched book, author Sally Coulthard traces the arc of the chicken from its ancestors among the dinosaurs through domestication by humans. Refreshingly, the book Foul Play doesn't repeat false claims from past chicken histories. Instead, it offers stories about the way chickens have shaped the human world, including the strange effects that domestication has had on chickens and humans alike. Chickens invaded our cultures and our language. Brooding men, hot chicks, and cocky youths. These are all part of our vocabulary. Folk magic and religion rely heavily on chickens and their eggs as both physical objects and symbols. Eggs have been viewed as metaphors for rebirth and as a harbinger of doom. One particularly eye-opening section of the book traces the role of chickens in medicine. Not only were chicken eggs integral to vaccine development, they are still used for developing proteins and flu shots, but experiments on chickens, some quite bizarre, led to some of our earlier understanding of blood vessels and organ transplants. For readers hoping to understand how the chicken got to be a species with such global dominance, Foul Play is a welcome addition to the canon. Yet it's focused on what people have done to or taken from chickens, more so than the story of the birds themselves. Of all animals, the author writes, chickens perhaps best represent the strange and often contradictory way we humans treat other species. Occasional mentions of scientific studies on chicken behavior simply present the information. She doesn't go as far to suggest these findings imply that we should treat chickens as more than mere commodities. Coulthard, who is a chicken keeper herself, does recognize the cost of our relationship with chickens from an ethical and environmental standpoint. One section explains why intensive chicken production is a major source of pollution and how widespread use of antibiotics for this production has been linked to the growing problem of antibiotic resistance. In foul play, the contradiction in how we treat chickens isn't just an abstract ethical conundrum. It is one with real consequences for our health and the health of our planet. This review of Foul Play, A History of the Chicken from Dinosaur to Dinner Plate, was written by Tove Danovich. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for joining me today, and please join me again next Sunday.